Ladies and gentlemen, it is that time once again. You are joining us for Hey Kids Comics, issue 64. I am your host, Andrew Farmer. With me, as always, is the devilishly handsome Jedi, Cole Houston.
Feeling devilish time. This is the last issue of this arc, isn't it?
Oh, I know. Which, it means we're exhausted. If you follow the countenance of what we do here, the cadence, the timber, you know that we tried to make up for issue 3 and issue 4, and now we're on to issue 5, and we've just kind of, we're right in the middle of, or the last quadrant of the denouement.
We're in the middle of the end here, apparently.
Yeah, the denouement is happening as we speak. We're sitting around drinking scotch in our smoking jackets at this point. That's where we are. Tonight, we are talking about Deconstructing Comics, All in the Family. Do I have that right?
You have it right. You have it all right.
All right. We're talking about Matthew McConaughey all show.
That's right.
All right.
Because but we want you to think about us when you're like, I can't do a decent McConaughey.
You can't. Yeah. And that's weird because if anybody could, I think it'd be you.
Yeah, and I think there's sort of like a built-in anti-impersonation case. At a certain level, there's a pitch that no human being other than McConaughey can meet.
I don't know about that. I can almost get it. I'm working.
Everyone will fall short, even the finest.
Even Matthew McConaughey falls short of doing
Matthew
McConaughey.
Even he cannot impersonate himself.
So
he just has to
we've
go
gone
with
over, in the Deconstructing Comics story arc, we've gone over what goes into the ego and the id and the making and what creates a hero and a villain, the best friend, the stalwart soldier of the hero. Last issue, we did the love interests, which I think we did a lot of justice to. It was a really good issue of Hey Kids Comics.
I think we've managed to really explore and deconstruct some amazing aspects and hopefully get you thinking about some of the things that are both expressed and implied in what's there.
Right. Tonight, we talk about the families. I want to start like this. The superhero family, the family of a superhero, the wife, the children, the parents, especially the parents, are probably the greatest catalyst in the toolbox of comic writers, because we've seen throughout the ages of comics, and we've talked about the different ages, it being used, whether it's, which we're going to get into at great length, the death of parents, or the kidnapping of children, or any of the tropes that have been used to drive a hero forward as
Absolutely.
A catalyst for change.
And, you know, that sort of vulnerability to have a family in danger. You know, you're by being a superhero, you're putting your family in harm's way, unless, of course, they're superheroes as well. But even then, you know.
Right. Even then. Well, here's the thing. The reason I like this issue, and this was brilliant planning on Cole's part, the reason that I like this issue coming in at the tail end of the story arc is because the more I think about it, the more it is all-inclusive of everything we've already talked about. It's inclusive of what creates a hero, because we talked about duty and guilt and vengeance and responsibility that goes into making most of the heroes. We talked about what makes a villain, whether it be hubris or greed, the stalwart friend of the hero, and of course the love interests of the hero. I think they all play a major role in this, because they're in either side. If you start at zero and if you go to negative 10 or positive 10, you've got family involved in those changes.
Yeah, and what's interesting is you don't see it enough, but the family dynamic actually does impact villains from time to time. We talked a bit about the motivations of, say, Sandman.
Oh, yes.
Which is the Marvel Sandman, God knows the DC Vertigo Sandman. That's a whole other family dynamic you don't want to touch.
But yeah, and also, if we're going to jump in at villains on family, Captain Boomerang and his son, who's the new Captain Boomerang, was a big one, because that was a double impact.
Yes, it was.
That was getting T-boned on both ends of your car at the same time for Tim Drake. Because in that same altercation, his father died. So we see his father die, and we see the original Captain Boomerang die, which drove Tim Drake to become more like Batman instead of being, you know, that was sort of his that was his coming of age into the superhero world, which
yeah,
it's so often
is. It was sort of a sad way to find common ground.
Right. And Captain Boomerang was then thrust into, you know, his father had just found him. He had a natural ability for boomerang throwing. I don't know whether that's a genetic trait. I don't know how that works.
I can't recall if his dad, you know, was super boomerang throwing or just really good at it.
See, I think he was just really good at it. And instead of going out and playing catch with his estranged son, he taught him how to throw razor boomerangs around in the park. Literally, that's what happened. So what we saw was the birth of a super villain or a razor's edge villain hero situation and the real kind of push into becoming a superhero instead of a teen titan. You know, or a teen superhero into an adult superhero at that point.
Absolutely. And like I said, you know, that's a very good example to cite because it's just everywhere. It's got family all over the place.
Yeah, family in comic books is fulcrum. Family is fulcrum. It's what it is the point on the triangle at which everything balances. And there are very few comic books that you can cite that don't involve family one way or another in the if not the origin of the hero or villain, an ongoing dramatic point in that comic book. Superman, obviously, would not have been Superman had Robin Hood not put him in a thing and shot him off into space. And who was Robin Hood's wife in that movie? Master and Commander wouldn't have shot him off into space.
Or Inspector Javert. Call him what you
right.
will.
You know, whatever floats your boat. He, Jor-El, instilled Kal-El with this vast responsibility. His parents instilled him with that responsibility.
And I think, you know, it just occurs to me, because we are very much talking about family and the family dynamic. And one of the tenets, if you will, of the family dynamic
mm-hmm.
is kind of getting pushed into things in a sort of Honey Boo Boo way. And I think that, you know, it never really occurred to me until just now. Jor-El was like the ultimate stage door dad. Because he knew full well, there were probably a couple other planets he could have sent him to. Apparently, he didn't aim his telescope toward Daxam.
Right.
Where Clark, or where, you know, Kal-El would have been like, Kal-El.
Or the Bottle City or Kandor.
Yeah, he didn't send him to Kandor. But, you know, young Kal-El would have grown up Kal-El, the poor, unfortunate orphan in school.
Yeah,
but instead, he wanted to live, albeit in his death, vicariously through his son by, like, making him a superstar.
You are bitter right now.
I am very bitter. I have found a way to darken the Superman.
We're going to get really dark. I think we need to keep it light right now because I have a feeling we're going to be treading some dark water waiting for the sharks to eat us for 2 hours. The most boring thing in the world. Oh, what was that movie called? Open Water? Oh, God, that thing was horrible.
That movie just keeps coming up in everything I'm on nowadays.
Superman, you know, that's the thing. We talked about what creates a hero and what we didn't say at the time or at least flush out is how much the parents or other family members, be it aunts or uncles or whoever, really instill those values in you before you become a superhero. Uncle Ben and Aunt May, obviously that there is cited evidence that with great power comes great responsibility. What came out of Ben's mouth about 1,000 times.
Yeah.
You know,
the
like
thing that is, he used to say that about like ridiculous things. Like, you know, Peter got put in charge of the group, the school,
the yearbook.
Yeah, and he's like, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. Dad, I'm just like junior editor.
Right. I'm selling entertainment.
Don't call me Dad. I don't know why he called him Dad just then. But
yeah, I'm not your dad. Like, he's selling entertainment books. Like, just, it's okay. You know, I'm going door to door. I'm trying to raise money. I'm selling gift wrap. With great power comes great responsibility. He finally got to use it correctly right before he died. God bless him. God bless Ben. I'm trying to think, Hal Jordan was another one. Hal Jordan's father, the test pilot, died in a plane crash. You know, instilling in him this need to live up to a hero in his own mind. And that's why he became who he was. That's why he had the duty, the determination, and the responsibility to become
who
he was.
Apparently a semi-suicidal desire to die in the same manner as his father.
We all have that.
I guess so.
I mean, that's another thing we can look at. Which is
ironic, if your father is still alive, that you would have that.
Right.
But apparently it is one of the things that we have. It's part of the human condition.
It really is.
No one knew this until now.
It's the circle of life. It moves us all. So what do you want to talk about with parents? We've kind of gotten into it, but we haven't really drilled down into anything yet. So.
Wow, that's a good one. You know, the parent is a good place to start because that's really ultimately, you know, where the family starts. So you've got young Kal-El there being sort of shuffled off to become something far greater than he would have pretty much anywhere
right.
else. You know, it's almost like dad fires him off in a rocket. If you live, call us.
Ultimate foster care. Just put you on a ship. And just fire you off into space.
But then, you know, he kind of lucked out in the standard continuity because then he got a really good set of parents out of the deal.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's not everybody is so lucky. I will say this, poor Batman. We should probably just do this. We could do this whole show on the Bat family and the parents.
Yeah,
we really could.
You know, we talk about it quite a bit previously.
And, we did.
You know, it's one of those things where that one's like the given. I mean, you pretty much tension anyone making the next Batman film. You don't really have to do all that.
We don't have to be. We don't have to go back over
by now.
For it, right.
In an alarming study, Philip Morris found that more kids recognize the origin story of Batman than recognize Joe Camel.
Really? That's where it went?
That is exactly where it went. I read that recently in my mind.
Right. I read it where I wrote it down.
That's right. Let me just scribble this out here so I can increase the veracity of that statement.
The effects of that moment in Bruce Wayne's life have reverberated through all of comic books since it happened. And not even just in the Bat family, but everywhere. You know, we talked about how it created this pathology in Batman so that no one would ever he wants to make it so no one would ever have to suffer from what he suffered through. We also talked about how his ego has overrode his id and made it so no matter what happens, if anybody drops some pearls, he has to pick them up. It's OCD, right? That's not what we were talking about.
It's almost like that thing on X-Files with the vampire, because you throw the seeds down, the sunflower seeds, and he has to pick them all up.
Exactly. It's OCD. No, that he can't use a gun. He'll never use a gun because, you know, his parents were killed in front of him with a gun. So no matter what the situation, no matter how awful it is, how easy it would be to solve the problem with a firearm, he's never going to do that. I really hope they stick to that because it makes for some interesting storytelling. We'll see what happens in the new 52. By the way, I was thinking about this when I was thinking about this episode, this issue. How bad did it suck when they decided they told all the writers? Right? They're like, all right, we're relaunching everything. Everything. And the writers go, how are we going to kill another 150 parents
exactly.
in the next month?
Like, it's going to be a bloodbath.
Like, come on, guys. Marvel has a less auspicious history with this.
And
but it's
before
still...
we move on from the Batman,
right?
I believe I've talked about this. There was a Batman special titled Player on the Other Side that pitted Batman against a character called the Wrath.
Okay.
And paralleled in a just, you know, an impossible sort of way this kid who saw his parents killed. His parents weren't the Dr. and Mrs. type. They were more criminals.
Okay.
And
okay.
Mom and Dad got gunned down by the cops. So he grew up bitter and angry and seeking vengeance on law enforcement for robbing
okay.
him of his childhood and his parents.
I think it's a fairly similar story to Prometheus, the character from the Grant Morrison run of the Justice League. I think it's a very similar story to that as well. But yeah, it's a time-honored tradition. The Graysons, for God's sakes. Anybody who, if you have a parent and you're adopted as a Robin, put them into witness protection, get them out of the country, whatever you have to do. Because there is an upside down penny in somebody's future if you have a parrot, and it's just a bad scene all around. You know, there's one member of the bat family that rarely gets talked about in this context. And I think it's important to talk about that character.
Is it Bat
because
Turtle?
It's different. It is Ace the Bat Hound.
Oh yes, not Bat Turtle after all.
More
yeah,
siblings.
Ace the Bat
than...
Hound. Well, you know,
no.
Ace, like Robin, was an adoptee.
Yes.
Because the one thing, if it's not picking up pearls, it's adopting strays.
Whatever the species of said stray might be. I was referring to Barbara Gordon, but that's just me.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well,
you
talk about somebody who really has a strange family relationship. I mean, most girls go and get a bunch of tattoos to get dad's attention. I'm just saying.
Right. Right. But some of that is responsibility instilled by father. Right. I don't think she would. If dad was a circuit bus driver or, you know, an accounting guy for Merrill Lynch, I don't think she would have become Batgirl. You know, she had something to prove.
That's true.
She had something to prove to her super cop daddy. And I think that coupled with the fact that she had a mat on for at some point Batman and at some other point Dick Grayson.
And who could blame her? Because, I mean, he's like he was in the circus.
Right.
That's one of the coolest. I mean, you know, if you're like in the bar and you're trying to pick up a chick and you're like, well, you know, I'm an executive vice president. And then the guy sitting next to you, and what do you do? I'm a circus acrobat. She's going home with Robin is all, you know, that's the way.
That's all you need to say, yeah.
Because, you know, for one thing, he can, like, do trapeze things that normal men can't.
That normal men couldn't.
But she also, I think, wants to prove something beyond that, is that I think she also wants to prove something to the world in a kind of quiet way. Because you can never really say, you know, I'm Barbara Gordon, or I'm that girl.
Right.
She wants to prove that to herself and to those in the know that a woman can choose a career in library science and still kick ass.
That's very true. I hadn't even thought about that. Like, librarians kick ass, all right? Like, even when she was Oracle, she kicked more ass as Oracle than she did as Batgirl. She was the information hub for the entire Bat family. That is not an easy task. That is difficult. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, Batman and the Bat family, it's textbook on deconstructing a family element. It shows you what it takes to drive a man to damn near madness, instill in him a great responsibility and great vengeance. You know, and poor Alfred, you want to talk about family, poor I think we should just retitle this entire story arc, Poor Alfred, has to deal with all this. You don't think Alfred, how long was he the Wayne family butler? Do we know?
Pretty much his entire life.
After he got out of the French Foreign Legion where he found that ruby the size of a fist or
That's
whatever
right.
it was. Whatever ridiculous crap that was. You know, it sort of breaks down everything hero, villain, you know, because there would be no... Okay, we discussed that there would probably be a Joker. He would just be a less focused Joker if there was no Batman. But there certainly would be a lot less need for the all-night costume shop in Gotham City if there was no Batman around. The effects on Dick Grayson, on Jason Todd, on Tim Drake, on Stephanie Brown, on anyone in that circle, in that gravitational pull has been insane. Is there any... Outside of what I was trying to think about was, is there anything outside of the Spider-Man family aspect in the Marvel universe that you can really point to? Well, I've got one. I've got a big one. That would be Magneto and Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch.
Oh, yes. Now, see, there, you know, one of the things we were going to probably or certainly be looking at was the Fantastic Four family dynamic.
Right.
And this is the opposite sort of thing where you're... Instead of, like, everybody going into the superhero business, you're kind of like initially following in dad's footsteps, then deciding to go into your own thing. Could have been library science. Turned out it was the Avengers.
Right, the X-Men. Right. And X-Factor and probably X-Force at some point and
probably
the Defenders.
So. They pretty much did the circuit. Everybody did in those days.
That's right. That's right. The bus and truck company Spamalot circuit there. It's interesting because they had something to prove to themselves that was going against what was instilled in them by their father. I find that to be pretty interesting. What do you do when you're Professor X and your son turns out to be Legion?
Yeah.
Or what was the other one? Krakatoa. What was the island?
Moria McTaggart's son, Proteus.
That's the one. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Who was the worst.
Yes, absolutely.
He was the worst. Like, how you... So that's another thing, right? That's another aspect of this that we haven't talked about is, what do you do when your son or your daughter is a total D-bag? Like, how does that affect you when you're a superhero and your son or your daughter turns out to be a total D-bag? Because it happens a lot, actually. Like, what do you do when you're Talia al Ghul and your son wants to be the complete opposite of you and go actually be on the side of Batman and not be your you know, king assassin? What do you do when Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch run off to join the Avengers instead of heading up your Brotherhood of Evil Mutants? It has to be fairly devastating as a parent for that to happen. And how do you... Okay, here's another one. Let's talk about the Fantastic Four.
Okay.
Because I think there's a lot of ground to cover in the Fantastic Four. And the one... There's a starting point for me, and it's this. How do you control an infinitely powerful child that you gave birth to? When you have Franklin Richards as your kid, how do you control that? How do you manage that situation? And how do you not feel guilty for everything, like, you know, you've released into the world this omnipowerful, the 10th level, you know, possible monster that's out there? That's just one of the things about the Fantastic Four. And I think, again, a lot of the family stuff comes back to what we were talking about with love interests, and that's just straight up, you love them. That's it.
Yeah.
You know? So tell me about the Fantastic Four.
Well, you know, the Fantastic Four is an interesting mix because two-fourths of them, half of them effectively, two-fourths being a really awkward way to express that.
I'd say half.
It still works in a strange sort of way. But you have half the group are brother and sister.
Right.
The other half are, you know, pals of some kind. And, you know, somehow you get this... It becomes almost like the Brady Bunch, because you get this sort of... This group will somehow form a family.
Right, right.
And, you know, the thing about it is that Sue and Reed were going to get married regardless.
Yes.
That was going to happen. So the family does expand, and Ben's kind of like the ad hoc uncle.
Right. Well, he's not even just the ad hoc uncle. They've been family friends for so long.
Yeah, you know, he's one of those friends that just becomes a family member.
Right. I think you can consider him family at this point. And, you know, we talked about Johnny Storm being a sad monster on the inside last episode.
But, you know, you have that kind of expanding family dynamic, and you have the irresponsible radioactive parents who decide to have kids together, and, you know, knowing full well the risk. So, you know, there's a whole lot of bizarre dynamic there, to be sure.
Is my memory served correctly that, you know, like any family, didn't Ben quit the family like 100 times?
Ben often left. He would often storm out. He'd go down to Yancey Street and in his giant oversized trench coat and sulk for a couple of days. And the Yancey Street gang would throw rotten eggs at him from a rotten egg vendor. And
they've got those there.
Yeah.
It's a food truck.
That's right. Because you never know.
You don't, especially on Yancey Street. You might always need to be pitching rotten eggs at people. So, I mean, you had every family dynamic in the Fantastic Four that I think you can possibly imagine.
Absolutely, and under various writers, you found that more and more so.
Right, right. You had the Civil War thing, which split the Fantastic Four in half, and John, I think it was Johnny and it was either Johnny and Sue went with Captain America, and Reed and Ben went with Tony Stark. So that fractured the family pretty much right down the middle.
Yeah,
which is
right,
a pretty
right in those two fourths,
right in this right in the middle, right in the 60% of the time it works every time, right down the center of that dynamic. You know, there is another family in the Marvel universe that bears talking about, and that would be the horrible, awful goings on. If it was a sitcom, it would be my two sons, and it would be the life and times of one Odin. Poor guy.
Of course.
Poor guy. I mean, you got one son who's just a braggadoche and kind of a dick, but wants to do the right thing. And then you've got this other son. Right, right. He's the center of the football team that always makes jokes and wears a cowboy. Oh, wait, that's Friday Night Lights. Never mind.
I thought that was strangely Nordic, though, that show.
It really was. To take place in Texas, it was pretty Nordic.
It was awfully Scandinavian in nature.
There was a lot of blondes. A lot of blondes.
Lemon curry.
And then you've got your other son, who is just a dick. But you can't be mad at him, because every once in a while, like every 150 years or so, he pulls his head out of his ass
and does
something amazing. You know, like helps out, solves a problem, stops the end of the world, whatever it might be. Granted, usually it's for some sort of selfish gain, but he still does it.
But it works out in the end. Yeah, it turns out that he's worth having around.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's the feel-good moment in the very special episode of My Two Sons with Odin Allfather, or whatever we're going to call him. So do you have any thoughts on, like, that dynamic, the Thor-Loki dynamic?
That, I think, what's interesting there is you have an exaggerated sibling dynamic.
Yeah.
You've got the everything about the sibling, the sort of love-hate, the jealousy, the Allfather likes you best.
Allfather knows best.
Exactly. You have all of those dynamics there, and you add to that, you know, kind of sense of godlike power and funky, you know, they've got a really cool house with a rainbow bridge and a Midgard serpent. And, you know, you've got a lot going on there, too. But at the end of the day, it becomes a lot like, you know, literally the gods themselves. They're one of those humanized pantheon.
Right, right. And you have sibling rivalry, which is something that I don't know if you get a lot. I can't think of any other incidents in comics of real sibling rivalry. But I don't know if you need another incident of sibling rivalry when you've got, you know, this epoch of sibling rivalry that raises and rears its ugly head every couple months. You got that. You've got, you know, the father, the forgiveness of the father to whatever Loki does. He's always going to lock him up. He's going to lock him up for a while, but he's still going to forgive him.
Oh yeah.
What about the Inhumans?
Now that's a big family dynamic, because you've got a bit of that sibling rivalry with Maximus, but at the same time, Maximus is insane. So where do we stand there on Maximus? But you do, you know, there you have that rarefied atmosphere. I think we talked a little bit about it being, you know, a royal family.
Right.
So that's taking it into a whole other place, because you've got kind of the patriarch, or the head, the top brother, you know.
Right.
The number one prince. And you can't really talk to him about much unless you want to do it like, you know, World According to Garp style with a chalkboard or something.
Unless you got Bruce Willis around to stand in the chamber.
Right. And pass on the information.
That's right. I think it's really interesting. And I think, again, we didn't necessarily talk about Medusa last issue.
Not as much, no. And you have to admit that she's probably, granted, she's an Inhuman. She's part Kree, part human, or whatever they were.
The Terrigen mists have been inside.
She's Terrigen mystified and all that. So you can't really, one of the problems you run into sometimes with characters is trying to look at them psychologically from a human perspective, because they've never had that. she didn't. There was no cheerleading squad. There was no, you know, necking with Black Bolt back when they were high school sweethearts. There's none of that because they didn't have that frame of reference. You know, how they met and fell in love and married, it's become sort of Pulp Fiction, however people meet people. But
that's right.
She has to be probably the best wife in the world, regardless of her humanity, or in this case, inhumanity, that she puts up with endless silence. I'll give you, can't talk. It's dangerous for him to talk. Does he ever leave notes?
I
don't think so.
Does he ever,
he's been around for 50 years. Did I ever see Jack Kirby so much as draw one greeting card? Left behind, you know, kind of slipped into the folds of her hair while she slept. So she'd find it in the morning when she went to, you know, brush it, or whatever one does when they have that much hair. So, you know, to stay devoted, she's either, there just isn't, you know, culturally there's not that much going for you as far as, you know, love and romance.
Right.
So, you know, she really has to put up with a whole lot. Plus, his entire family, lives in the same house with them.
That's true.
So you've got his brothers, and, you know, they're always hanging around. They're probably always checking her out, you know, because she's got the big hair going on. So they're probably country music fans. So they really go for the big hair women. She's, you know, her hair is beyond regulation height.
It is. You cannot get on roller coasters with that hair. That is just a fact. Did you ever get the sense that she was sort of the outcast, the outside of
like the one who's sort of like a member of the family, but not, because she married into it?
Right.
That's an interesting point, idea? Because there is that kind of vibe sometimes, I think, without it actually, whether it was intentional or not.
Well, keep in mind that Karnak's a dick anyway.
Yeah.
Well. So we can't really hold him accountable. So is a...
Morgan?
Hoofy McHoofferson over there. One step away from Renta. He's just an ass all the time. So let's not rule that out. I mean, they aren't nice necessarily, alright? That's the way that works. I'm just saying, they're not the nicest people in the world.
No,
And it can't be easy to be very nice when your leader can't tell you to stop being a dick.
Well,
and if he does tell you
I guess
to stop,
he just doesn't know how to write or something.
It's so frustrating. It has to be so frustrating to like have to find something to write with. And like you said, he could just have a chalkboard around his neck all the time, just wandering around writing stuff on it. But it doesn't. I'll be honest. It doesn't have the same. It doesn't lend itself to the same flair. If you write "stop being a dick,"
that's true.
On a chalkboard,
I mean, no matter how many exclamation points or all caps or however you do it, it's
right, italics or however you do it, it's still not going to.
And even Bruce Willis can't do it the full measure of justice that doing it yourself would if you could.
Right, he comes out and is like, "Yeah, stop being a dick,"
so
and
I
you're
think
like,
in a way,
"No."
Perhaps Medusa isn't as much patient as she is. I don't know, like sympathetic.
Like partially deaf?
Deaf, one of the two. Yeah, because it's not many men who their whispering sweet nothings will take the top of your head off.
Right.
Just clean off, right off the top. And I don't, this is an interesting thing, because I'm racking my brain here trying to think, speaking of sibling rivalries, have we, because you know, you've got Cyclops and Havoc, you've got your Summers brothers.
Right. No matter what time period they might be thrown
and they're big
into or who they might.
Oh, it's Smothers Brothers. But, you know, they got the deadbeat dad off in space. But they've each got powers, very vastly different, but incredibly devastating powers. And, of course, you know, Scott's got the whole, I can't, it's like, well, that's another story. But have there been any really, like, sibling relationships where you don't have... Where, like, one has a power, one's a superhero, and one's not. And I'm trying to think of where that's ever happened.
I'm sure it's happened.
Yeah, I know. It's like, it's so obvious. Somebody has to have done it, but I cannot place having seen it myself.
I'm trying to think about superheroes that have siblings. And I'm not talking like long lost retconned, I've been your brother all along type siblings. Like, there has to be superheroes that aren't like only children. Right? I mean, I can't be wrong about that. Like, Batman, no siblings. Superman, as far as we know, no siblings. Captain America, was it ever discussed? Does he have a brother or sister out there somewhere?
You know, when they were exploring, trying to, like, inject some sort of pathos into the Hulk's life, into Banner's life?
Right.
And he's got the abusive father that they worked in. Did he have a brother? Did he have a sibling, brother or sister?
Yes, yes, okay, he did.
I guess it's a little different there because, you know, the Hulk's kind of on again, off again as far as...
I've got a big one. I've got a big one that just dawned on me when I was thinking about this. Especially in the current incarnation as it's been written in the past 10 years, Iron Fist.
Huh.
And here's why. Do you want to talk about responsibility and duty? And I think we talked a little bit about Iron Fist's duty at the time, but let's talk about his familial responsibility. He's like third generation Iron Fist.
Oh,
you do not
okay.
have a choice at that point but to be Iron Fist. Like, you know, when your grandfather finds the lost city of Kung Lung and you were chosen as, you know, the pale skinned carrier of the Iron Fist to fight down the dragon and whatever, you know, and it's just passed down from generation to generation. That is some heavy shit right there. That, you know, all Danny Rand wants to do is go surfing and drink Mai Tais and chat up the ladies, and he has to carry this giant weight along with the power to summon his chi into his fist and punch through things, and you don't have a choice. You aren't given the option to opt out of that. That is just who you are now. That's heavy.
Yeah, well, you also... kind of, you know, it goes back to that whole, you know, being pushed into the business, as it were.
Right.
It's like, you know, you're going to, it was good enough for me. It's like Monster's Ball.
Yeah, okay, continue.
It's Peter Boyle continue. And Monster's Ball. You know, it's like, there's only one occupation, this family, corrections officer. And it's like, you know, I can just see Danny Rand's dad sitting there in the lounge chair. Saying,
right, it's like a
super Iron Fist is what we do. It's the family business.
It's like being a cop in Boston. You know, it's like your dad was a cop, his dad was a cop, his dad was a cop. You're gonna be a cop. That's the only thing that we know. That's the only thing you're gonna do, and that's the way it is. You know, there's one, because we're kind of all encompassing this. There's one we didn't talk about last issue that I'm remiss for not talking about, because I think it's a really interesting dynamic, and I think it really...
you knew I was going to go there.
I was like, son of a bitch, Shang-Chi. It really defines the character and his, and to some extent, his descent into madness, and that is Dr. Doom. Because if you remember right, Dr. Doom, super scientist, roommate of... Reed Richards in college, you know, one of the smartest guys in the room, in any room by any given right, extremely intelligent, but he starts to dabble in the occult, and he starts to dabble in the occult because his wife dies and he wants to bring her back. So that is where a lot of his mystic power outside of his just technological techno powers come from.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it drove him into the arms of madness.
Absolutely.
That he could not use this power to bring back his deceased wife. You know, crazy gypsies and all that stuff happened, but yeah, I wanted to touch on that because I was thinking about the show and what I missed, what I wanted to say, and that was one of the things I wanted to make sure that I brought up.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things I wanted to bring into this, because I like to go obscure and not just Shang-Chi, and I'll run in there real quick. He, you know, his dad's Fu Manchu, so, you know, there's huge strikes against growing up ordinary. And
yeah.
Plus, dad's always constantly bugging you to kind of come over to the dark side and, you know, why don't you just try a sip of the Elixir Vitae? Sip. I mean, you don't have to drink the whole bottle. Just to taste it, you know. And meanwhile,
right.
His sister, Phalo Sui, is running around, you know, monkey wrenching everything that
kazoo tights.
That the spies are doing. She's like playing the middle against both ends because she like sometimes she'll inform on dad and sometimes she'll be working with dad.
Right.
And so you've got a lot of that going on where you've just had the most dysfunctional family in comics, I would wager to say. But
that's a strong statement.
Yeah. But
that's a really strong, most dysfunctional family in comics.
When you've read as many of those as I have, you know from whence I'm speaking.
That's true. But I'm trying to think, are there any more dysfunctional families, further dysfunction, you know, in comics? We know that the Bat family's dysfunctional, but they aren't blood related. So we kind of got to let that go. Superman's family, because they got a cousin showing up every, they got a revolving door.
Mm-hmm.
Alien anchor baby system, apparently, where they just show up every 6 months and they stay for 6 months and then they're naturalized citizens at that point, I guess. Okay. You're going out on a limb. I'm going out on a limb with this.
All right.
Mount Wundagor, high evolutionary, crazy animal people.
Yeah, I mean, talk about make your own family, or, you know.
Exactly.
Who says you can't choose your family?
Exactly.
Is what that comes down to.
That is my most dysfunctional family in comics. is the high evolutionary making, you know, Ugnaughts in his basement so that he has somebody to talk to. That, and arming them with weird laser cannons. That is my most dysfunctional family. In the comic books, right there. I see your Shang-Chi, and I'm not going to raise it with high evolutionary, but I'm calling. I'm calling.
Call me, okay.
I'm calling you. I'm trying to think. I mean, there's so many. That's the problem, is there's so many screwed up families. Anybody who's had a mutant child in the 70s, that family screwed up.
And also, Bobby, that reminds me of something I wanted to ask if it was ever very adequately explored, is, and apart from, I'm guessing to some degree, the Worthingtons, but the whole family dynamic when, okay, a good example would be the Prides.
Okay.
And I think that they kind of knew Kitty was special and not just, you know, super smart and
right,
a real go-getter. Right. But I mean, I think they knew that there was something up with her.
Yeah.
You know, they had the good sense to send her over to Xavier's camp rather than the, what is it, like the, you know, the Magnus program. Which, you know, even the brochure was aloof as to what exactly
as to what it was. It's like a, what are those schools, the magnet schools, no pun intended. But the not the Moriarty school. They're like the Goddard schools, you know, like the ones that are really weird and.
Yeah.
Can you use vouchers? Can you use school vouchers for Xavier's Institute for Higher Learning? Has anybody looked into that?
There's a scholarship program where Professor Xavier shows up and says, "Oh, guess what? You've got a scholarship." My ex.
Right.
What? Where?
Wait, nothing. What am I now? Nothing. Just get in the car.
You won't remember this anyway.
Another family dynamic. Both have mutant powers. So this, I still haven't thought of that yet. I still haven't found that. Peter and Ileana Rasputin, Magic and Colossus, is a weird family dynamic because Magic is part demon. How does that happen? Like, you can turn yourself into organic metal and your sister has a demon sword now. How does that make you feel?
Yeah,
like, you're a devout Catholic and...
Well, that and... You've got the family there where I think her mutant power was a kind of a teleportation, if I remember correctly, her stepping discs. And then she hauls off and gets a demon as well. And,
yeah,
you know,
she does.
Think Reptevia in Fiddler on the Roof was disappointed. Imagine, you know, what happens when your youngest daughter, when your only daughter comes home and, oh, Daddy, I have a demon in me. Couldn't you get pregnant like a regular teenager?
Right. Where'd you get that sword? What's happening? You have horns? You have horns now?
Yeah.
Is this?
I have no daughter.
I have no daughter. But, I'm glad I have a giant hulking man son that can turn into organic.
Yeah, and apparently destroy rather than simply stop a runaway tractor on the collective back in his first appearance.
Exactly. Like, couldn't you? It can't have been going that fast.
Well, I think they wanted to. It was sort of the precursor to Smallville. How many doors could Clark simply have opened? Just turn a knob, Clark. You don't have to yank it off its hinges and throw it 16 feet in the opposite direction. No one would ever suspect you have superpowers then.
Three things about the Colossus origin story. Number one, the collective in Russia, there weren't that many tractors.
Exactly. That's what bothers me to this day.
Number two, it couldn't have been going that fast as to run up on you so you have to turn into organic metal.
Oh, yeah. Even if full tilt, a Cold War era Russian tractor, probably not that impressive.
Number three, it's not a quiet machine. It's not going to sneak up on you.
That's right. It could have been the new stealth tractor technology.
The KGB was developing. I defy that. I defy that origin story. I stand by that deference. I will go to the ends of the earth defying that origin story. What about Black Canary? Because wasn't Black Canary's mom Black Canary?
Oh, yeah, the original. So you've got that kind of, I'm going there, Silk Spectre dynamic in
a
sense.
There we go. Okay, this is how I know we're going to wrap up the show soon. All right, so take it away with, let's tie the Watchmen into this, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got that inevitable, I think one of the key things you find in a superhero family where the superpowers are passed down from generation or there is some superpower coming through down the pike that one was for Stu. You know, you've got this imp, or even if it's not a superpower, if you're just like a costume crime fighter, there's this sort of push to get into the business.
Right.
Be it good or bad. And, you know, from just like demanding that your daughter train constantly and be a gymnast and a Olympic level athlete so she can go cold cock criminals to playing catch with razor sharp boomerangs and stuff.
Right.
There's always that sort of emphasis to follow in my footsteps, to fulfill or be a part of my legacy.
And Watchmen was really about that.
Oh, absolutely.
There was a huge part of the Watchmen because you had Silk Spectre, you had Night Owl.
Well, you know,
were there any other?
This late in the game, this is a sad point to start to realize just how much of a family dynamic.
Yep.
Played into that, because you have with Silk Spectre that stage door mom, that living vicariously through your children. You have, you know, Dryburgh, you have Night Owl disappointing his father and being interested in romantic things and science and such rather than finance. You have Dr. Manhattan, you have Osterman, who's pushed into nuclear physics by his father, who's a visionary and a kook. So you have all of these, and then you have the god awful worst family dynamic ever with a young would be Rorschach.
Oh my God, yeah.
So don't get, you know, perhaps I was wrong about the Manchu family being the most dysfunctional in comics.
Can we call them the Manchu family?
The Manchu family. The Brighton Manchus, by the way.
Yes, exactly. I'd like to introduce you to Trenton Manchu of the Bedfordshire I can't say Manchus without foo at the beginning. I can't do it. Manchus.
Manchus.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. I think that The Watchmen was a very family-heavy book.
Yeah, and I never really looked at it from that angle before. Now everything's just sort of flooding in. It's like, good night. It was just like the worst and the best and worst of family going on and what that meant as a family. A real quick obscure one I want to bring up just because I want to plug this series because it's so damn good was at least the first few years of Astro City.
Okay, yeah.
Which they're just like jumping on everything, every convention, every anything. And there was a family in there that was obviously the Fantastic Four dynamic called the First Family.
Okay.
F-I-R-S-T, but their last name of those who were related was F-U-R-S-T.
Okay. Okay.
It was as much a nod to the Fantastic Four as it was a nod to luminaries in comics, because there was sort of this kind of Jack Kirby, Julius Schwartz feel going on with a couple of the characters.
That's cool.
Especially since one of them was like smoking a weird Kirby-esque pipe full of Kirby energy stuff coming out of it.
Kirby crackles popping all over the place.
The Kirby crackles.
By the way, if there was ever a cereal called the Kirby Crackles, I would eat the shit out of that cereal. I would not stop.
How could you stop? I mean, it's Kirby Crackles.
Right.
It's part of this complete breakfast.
It comes out of a Kirby cocoon. It's gross, but it's tasty.
Well, you kind of pinch the ends of it like one of those coin purses people used to have. And the cereal
wow.
just... Yeah.
One of those awful rubber, smelly coin purse
exactly.
things.
The Kirby Crackles taste a little rubbery, but who cares? They're.
Oh, I think I threw up in my mouth just now. Gah, gah.
Suddenly,
all right,
you're
all
not
right.
going to eat the shit out of that cereal.
I would if it didn't come in a if it came in an actual Kirby cocoon and not something my grandfather had in 1964 that he got from bank from opening a checking account and then called it a Kirby cocoon, I probably would. But now I'll never be able to do it because now I'm going to be thinking about that penny that's been stuck inside of the bottom of that thing for the past 40 years, and that's where my cereal's coming out of, like some sort of alien child.
It's like, what is that at the bottom? A prize? No, it's a penny that's been It's been sweated into place.
It's literally a hay penny that's melted into this thing and melded to the point where there's no distinction. It doesn't know. I can't tell you where the penny stops and the coin purse starts anymore. And by the way, my next album will be entitled Where the Penny Starts and the Coin Purse Stops. It's just, I'm writing a children's book to go along with it. It's going to be fantastic. Bobby Blakey's going to do the art, which is the funniest part. Of that joke. Do you want to wrap this up? Let's wrap this up.
We should wrap this up. I think we have talked about nearly everything we possibly could in so short a time. There is far too much that we haven't got to.
Right.
There's never enough time to do it all.
There isn't.
But again,
so,
I think we have done justice to...
I think so. What's next week?
Next week...
Do we know?
Because of our proximity...
Ah, yeah.
...to All Hallows Eve.
Oh, yeah.
We are going to bring you the wonderful world of comics that go bump in the night.
That's awesome. I can't wait to break out my awful Bela Lugosi impression,
absolutely.
Which is the same as my good one.
I think we need to impersonate Bela Lugosi, that other guy, Boris Karloff.
That other guy. Peter Lorre.
Yeah, Peter Lorre. I think Vincent Price. You name it. We want to bring all as many conventions of horror into this as possible in the classic sense. But yes, you know, horror is a very important genre of comics. And what
it
better
is.
Time than as close as we're going to get this year?
Right. Listen to the comics of the night. What beautiful music they make. See, that's just a, I'm just giving you
like
a taste.
Bela Lugosi and it's like Drago from... Rocky.
It was a little like Hans Gruber doing Bela Lugosi.
Yeah,
it was a little
really
like
sure.
Alan Rickman doing a Bela Lugosi.
I couldn't quite pinpoint that one.
I've actually been working on my Hans Gruber doing impressions of other people impression. So it's very specific. It's very specific. I gave up on just doing regular impressions. So I think this was an awesome story arc.
Oh, this
I'm so glad
one of the
we did
best
it.
Yet.
I think it was. I know. I can tell you this. For me, it was extremely eye opening. There were moments in this story arc that it never in my 36 years, in my 30 years of reading comic books, never dawned on me. You
oh,
know,
no.
like
it was amazing to not only see what we would come up with, but kind of really to take a look at things that we'd already seen in a new light.
Exactly, like J. Jonah Jameson being the worst supervillain ever created still blows my mind.
I said it, and it blows my mind. I don't know where that came from, but there
the brilliant place. The fact that we discovered that guilt really is what drives the superhero, I think.
It's a big guilt sandwich, really.
It's really a big guilt sandwich. The fact that Cole and I came to an accord between greed and hubris... the fact that we discovered that, you know, love conquers all boundaries, and when it comes to comic books, that all comic books almost every comic book at some point has had a really good love story in it that translates from the writer and probably something they were going through or something they wanted to express. And that is something I want to close this arc with. Okay. This is the main reason that I wanted to do this was we look as comic book fans, we look at comic books as sentient creatures. We see them in their finished form as creatures of their own accord that speak to us and move through the world on their own. And they're not. And that is a very hard thing for a real comic fan to grasp. That these books are not, they don't come out of the womb as these books. They aren't created out of the ether and then all of a sudden they're stories with art and color and they look this way. These are creations by men and women, by people, to tell you a story. And for the most part, if you go to conventions and you talk to creators or read biographies or just understand what's going on, there's stories that come from their own lives. There's a reason that the family element in comic books is so powerful. It's because the family element in all of us is that powerful. There's a reason that love conquers all, because it does. There's a reason that guilt is such a strong motivator, because it is.
Exactly.
And that's the thing about the writers, the artists, the inkers, the letterers, all that stuff gets put together. And if it wasn't a unifying human condition, we would not get the end result that we do. And that was why I wanted to do this arc so badly, was to understand that.
Well, what's fascinating, what I come away from this arc with, is one of the things that if we're doing our job right, such as it's a job, but if we're doing this right, you come away from every one of these episodes with thinking about the familiar in a different way, or perhaps going back and getting the comics that you read, that you like, and, you know, ones that we didn't even touch on, or we've probably never read ourselves, and saying, you know, I'm going to go back and look at this with a new set of eyes. I'm going to kind of analyze this, and hopefully we've made you more thoughtful, especially with this arc, because we just have thrown every ounce of our brain power at overanalyzing. And
there wasn't a single mention of the Great Lakes Avengers or Squirrel Girl in this story arc until now.
Yes.
You're welcome. Everyone is welcome.
And I think that is a testament to how thoughtful this arc was.
I make no promises for the next issues,
absolutely,
but this arc.
Thankfully, neither Great Lakes Avengers or Squirrel Girl are largely synonymous with horror, apart from the horror they visit upon comics by existing.
That's true. That's true.
So, you know, as we often say about enjoying comics, I would say also scrutinize and analyze comics from time to time, just as a good mental exercise, because at their best, they are illustrated prose.
Exactly. Still, in my opinion, the comic book, the sequential art form, is the best medium to tell a story. I still believe that to this day. And I love movies, I love TV, I love novels, I love poetry. I will stand by this till the best way to tell a story. All right, we're going to wrap it up. Here we go. So, next week, we have... Cole, do you have any final thoughts before I go forward?
I think I really covered everything as to
okay,
just how amazingly thought-provoking for both of us and this arc was. And
it really
was.
It was
one I was anxious to get to.
Okay. So, next week, we're going to get our horror on. We're probably going to have at least one or two Frankensteins, three or four Wolfmen. It's really like playing Go Fish with Universal Monsters. So that's going to be fun. As always, buy, sell, and as Cole said, scrutinize your comic books. Go look up biographies of your authors. Read into them. See what they're like of the artists as well. And really try to understand where they're coming from when they're trying to tell you a story. And I think you're going to be really, really surprised by the way everything has panned out. With that being said, we'll see you next week. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
And signing off for Hey Kids Comics, good evening.